Chapter 18. Leadership Lesson 2. So goes the leader, so goes the culture. I before you, me before we. He wanted to be in charge. He wanted to be the leader. And no one was going to stand in his way, not even the current leader. This is how Saddam Hussein came to power in Iraq. Even before he took power, he formed strategic alliances that would bolster his position and help ensure his own rise. And once in power, he showered his allies with wealth and position to keep them loyal. He claimed to be on the side of the people, but he wasn't. He was in it for himself, for the glory, fame, power, and fortune. And all his promises to serve were part of his strategy to take. The problem with such transitions is that they create a culture of mistrust and paranoia. Though things may be functional while the dictator is in power, once ousted, the whole country is left on shaky ground for years to come. These stories are not exclusive to the rise of dictators in unstable nations or plots of HBO series. All too often, similar scenarios play out in modern corporations. Stanley O'Neill's ascent at Merrill Lynch in 2001 is just one example. Born during the heart of the baby boom in the small town of Wadawi in eastern Alabama, O'Neill, the grandson of a former slave, went to Harvard Business School on a scholarship from General Motors. He later took a job at GM and quickly rose through the ranks of the firm's treasury department. But he had his sights on other things, bigger things. And so, despite having no real interest or experience in the brokerage business, he moved on to Wall Street. One of only a handful of African Americans to make it to the top rungs of the banking industry, O'Neill had the opportunity to become one of the great leaders of our day, a symbol of what's possible in America. But he chose a different path. In 1986, he joined Merrill Lynch, and within a few years had become head of the junk bond division, which, ironically enough, would, under his leadership, become the biggest junk bond operator after Drexel Burnham Lambert's Michael Milken pleaded guilty to securities fraud in 1990. O'Neill later took over Merrill's huge brokerage division, eventually becoming the firm's CFO. When the internet bubble burst in the late 1990s, he quickly laid off thousands of employees, impressing his boss, then CEO David Kamansky, with his boldness while cementing his growing reputation as a ruthless manager. In mid-2001, with Kamansky as his ally, O'Neill elbowed out several other contenders to become president of the company. But he wanted more. O'Neill wanted to do away with Merrill Lynch's employee-centric culture, something he saw as an obstacle. Affectionately known as Mother Merrill, a hint to the days when the culture was more balanced and human, Merrill Lynch was a great place to work. It was no secret, however, that O'Neill despised the culture, viewing it as soft and unfocused, something that got in his way. With no interest in fostering any particular healthy corporate culture, the business was all about competition. And a competitive atmosphere is, indeed, what he created. The culture he engineered was not one in which the people of Merrill simply competed furiously with outsiders. This was a culture in which people competed intensely against each other. Again, a leader always sets the tone inside an organization, and putting oneself before others was the tone O'Neill set. When 9/11 struck, Merrill was deeply affected, with hundreds of employees injured and three killed. Yet during the 12 months of emotional upheaval following the tragic event, like other Wall Street firms, O'Neill laid off thousands of employees and closed offices. Having marginalized his rivals by 2002, O'Neill's chess game was complete. The Merrill board forced his old friend Kamansky to retire early and made O'Neill chairman and CEO. With the gregarious Kamansky gone, the cultural transformation was nearly complete. Though not perfect, Kamansky would at least occasionally wander down to the employee cafeteria to eat with the others. O'Neill saw no value in that. He had no interest in fraternizing with his people. Instead, he used a private elevator to reach his office on the 32nd floor. Employees were also instructed not to speak to him in the halls and to stay out of his way if he passed by. Never one to let a good perk go to waste, on weekends, O'Neill would use the corporate jet to fly to his home on Martha's Vineyard. We work to advance the vision of a leader who inspires us, and we work to undermine a dictator who means to control us. And as the trust evaporated, it should come as no surprise that O'Neill's biggest threat, as in any dictatorship, would come from within. In a circle of safety, The people work to protect their leader as a natural response to the protection their leader offers them. This was not the case at O'Neill's Merrill, however. O'Neill's direct reports had begun working behind the scenes to put pressure on the Merrill board to undermine him. O'Neill caught wind and quickly squelched his opposition. It wouldn't take long for O'Neill to completely isolate himself at the top, allowing the culture of Merrill to be almost entirely driven by the intoxication of dopamine and the dread and paranoia of cortisol. The days of Mother Merrill were long gone. By this point, the attention of the firm's leadership was focused on creating the high-risk bonds that would help fuel the rise and collapse of the mortgage market. Is it any wonder the company was in no position to ward off the trouble that was about to befall it? In the summer of 2006, the investment chief, Jeff Kronthal, warned O'Neill of dangers ahead. Instead of working with Kronthal or implementing any safeguards for the good of the company, O'Neill fired him. O'Neill believed that if there was trouble ahead, only he could manage it, and so he tightened his grip to keep all the control. In October 2007, the company announced it had lost over $2.2 billion in the third quarter and written off $8.4 billion in failed investments. Finally, O'Neill's reign had come to an abrupt and inglorious end. He had successfully managed to isolate himself from his employees and his board, topped off by a decision to reach out to Wachovia about a possible merger without first discussing it with his directors. Any support he might have gotten was gone. How much was all that control worth? O'Neill left Merrill Lynch in disgrace with a severance package worth more than $160 million. I'm often amused by the irony of CEOs who believe in a pay-for-performance incentive model inside their companies, then expect huge payouts when they leave the company in shambles. Why do shareholders and boards not write into their contracts a prohibition against any severance if a CEO leaves the company in disgrace? Would that not at least be consistent and in the best interest of the company and its shareholders? But I digress. O'Neill represented an extreme version of the thinking that had taken over Wall Street, and in the end, it caused his downfall. He had isolated himself from the people he led, and making matters worse, he had so successfully fostered internal competition that, not surprisingly, those who had once been on his team turned against him. As I have already shown, the problem is not how a company conducts its business per se. The problem lies with the quality of relationships within the organization, starting with the leader. The more attention a leader focuses on their own wealth or power, the more they stop acting like a leader and start taking on more of the attributes of a tyrant. Mark Bowden wrote a remarkable piece about Saddam Hussein in the Atlantic Monthly. In it, he describes how the tyrant leader exists only to preserve his wealth and power. And this is the problem. Power, as Bowden further explains, gradually shuts the tyrant off from the world. And as we already know, when distance is created, abstraction settles in, and soon after comes the paranoia. The tyrant sees the world against them, which only compels them to shut out even more people. They set up more and more rigid controls around their inner circle, and as their isolation increases, the organization suffers. Absent any care from above, those inside the organization are less likely to cooperate. Instead, competing against each other becomes the best way to advance. And when that happens, the success individuals in the group may enjoy will not be met with congratulations from others, but with jealousy. If a leader were purely evil, or if we believed there was no chance to enter their inner circle, then the seeds of rebellion would form. But when the possibility exists that we might make it in, or if, on the other hand, we're unsure whether we will be thrown to the wolves, we become almost immobilized. It is the rustle in the grass, the fear of what may be lurking, that initiates the flow of cortisol into our bloodstreams. It is the cortisol that makes us as paranoid and focused on self-preservation as the isolated leader above. This is what O'Neill did at Merrill. He changed the culture from one that offered certainty of protection to one of uncertainty. And, as in Iraq, there was no solid foundation left for the company to sustain itself. There just wasn't enough trust to go around. O'Neill's rise and fall is not just a story of how one man's ambition can bring down a company. In the end, everyone and everything suffers in these conditions. All that control focused at the top can lead to only one outcome: eventual collapse. True power. David Marquet was a career submariner. Graduating near the top of his class from the Naval Academy, he's a pretty smart guy. In fact, it's partly because of his smarts that he climbed his way up the ranks of the U.S. Navy. Knowing the right answers, he was able to give good instructions and issue good orders. He was the leader because he was in control. At least, that's what he'd been taught. The Navy, like many organizations, rewards smart, goal-oriented people with recognition and promotion. And so, Captain Marquet was recognized and promoted. He worked his way up to earn one of the great honors any naval officer could earn, his own command. He was to be captain of the USS Olympia, a nuclear-powered Los Angeles-class fast attack submarine. The Navy has boomers, huge submarines that carry unlaunched nuclear missiles. The smaller, nimbler, fast attack subs are designed to hunt down the other guy's boomers and, if it came to it, destroy them before they had a chance to launch their missiles. An elaborate game of cat and mouse played across the expanse of the globe's oceans, and Captain Marquet was now a key player in the game. To prepare for the big job, Captain Marquet spent a year studying Olympia's systems and crew, and in typical Marquet fashion, he worked hard to learn as much as he could. He learned every wire, every pipe, every switch the Olympia had. He pored through the personnel files to get to know everything he could about his crew. Like many people in charge, he felt he needed to know as much, if not more, than his crew to be a credible leader. Given the importance and honor of his new position, this time was not going to be an exception. Less than 2 weeks before Captain Marquet was scheduled to take command of the Olympia, he got an unexpected call from the powers that be. There was a change in plans. He would not be captaining the Olympia after all. Instead, he was assigned to take command of the USS Santa Fe, a slightly newer Los Angeles-class submarine. But there was one other little detail. The crew of the Santa Fe ranked last in nearly every readiness and retention measurement the Navy had. While the Olympia was considered the best of the best, the Santa Fe was at the bottom, the bad news bears of nuclear subs. But Captain Marquet was a smart guy and saw the change as a challenge. Like many a senior executive with a strong ego and a big brain, he saw himself as the one who could take charge and turn this ship around. If he gave good orders, he would have a good ship. And if he gave great orders, he would have a great ship. At least that was his plan. And so, on January 8, 1999, Captain Marquet stepped off the dock at Pearl Harbor and onto the $2 billion, slightly longer than a football field vessel, that 135 crew members would now call home. As one of the newest ships in the fleet, the Santa Fe had a good deal of equipment that was different from what Captain Marquet had trained up on for the Olympia. For someone used to being in control, to being in a situation they don't fully understand, they can often be blind to their own ignorance. Or worse, they may choose to hide what they don't know for fear of having others question their authority. Even though he knew he'd have to rely on his crew more to fill the gaps in his knowledge, Captain Marquet kept that fact to himself. His technical knowledge was the basis for his leadership authority, and with that gone, he, like many leaders, worried he would lose the respect of his crew. As it turns out, old habits die hard. Instead of asking questions to help him learn, Captain Marquet defaulted to what he knew best, being in control, and started issuing orders. And it seemed to work. Everything seemed to go smoothly. The crew jumped to his words, an aye-aye here and an aye-aye there. There was no question who was the boss. The serotonin flowed through Captain Marquet's veins, and it felt good. The next day, while out at sea, Captain Marquet decided to run a drill. He had the nuclear reactor manually shut down to simulate a reactor failure. He wanted to see how his crew would react if faced with the real thing. And for a while, everything seemed to go well. The crew performed all necessary checks and precautions and switched to running the submarine on battery-powered motor, or EPM. Though not nearly as powerful as the nuclear reactor, the EPM could keep the submarine running at slow speeds. But the captain wanted to push his crew further to see how they would do with a little more pressure. He gave the officer of the deck, the ship's navigator and most experienced officer on board, a simple instruction: ahead 2/3. This meant that he wanted the crew to run the electric motors at 2/3 of their maximum power. It would drive the ship faster, but it would also run the batteries down more quickly, which would add a sense of urgency to get the reactor up and running again. The officer of the deck acknowledged the captain and repeated the order out loud, instructing the submarine's driver to turn up the speed. Ahead 2/3, he said to the helmsman. And nothing happened. The submarine's speed remained the same. Captain Marquet peered out from behind the periscope to look at the junior enlisted crew member who should have executed the order. The young sailor, sitting at the controls, was squirming in his seat. "Helmsman," Captain Marquet called out, "what's the problem?" To which the young sailor replied, "Sir, there is no 2/3 setting." Unlike every other submarine Captain Marquet had ever been on, the newer Santa Fe didn't have a 2/3 setting on the battery-powered motor. Captain Marquet turned to the navigator, who'd been aboard for over 2 years, and asked him if he knew there was no 2/3 setting. "Yes, sir," replied the officer. Dumbfounded, Captain Marquet asked him, "Then why did you issue the order?" "Because you told me to," said the officer. It was at that point that Captain Marquet was forced to face the reality of the situation. His crew had been trained to follow instructions, and he had been trained for another submarine. And if everyone was going to blindly follow his orders simply because he was in charge, then something very, very bad could happen. "What happens when the leader is wrong in a top-down culture? Everyone goes off a cliff," Captain Marquet would later write. If he was going to succeed, he would have to learn to trust his bottom-ranked crew more than he trusted himself. He had no choice. A nuclear-powered submarine is not like a company. In a company, we think that when things go wrong, we can simply replace our staff or change technology to make it work better. It's an option that a good too many leaders of companies think is an advantage. It also assumes that the right people are being let go and the right people are being hired. But what if we're forced to run our companies like Captain Marquet had to run his submarine? He couldn't return to shore and ask for a better crew and a more familiar ship. This is the challenge that Marquet now faced. As much as he knew and as smart as he was, everything he thought he knew about leadership was wrong. He couldn't have his crew blindly follow his orders anymore. The consequences could be devastating. Now he needed everyone to think, not just do. "Those at the top," explains Captain Marquet, "have all the authority and none of the information. Those at the bottom," he continues, "have all the information and none of the authority. Not until those without information relinquish their control can an organization run better, smoother, and faster and reach its maximum potential." The problem, Captain Marquet says, was that he was addicted to being in control. And the crew, like in so many organizations that follow a flawed interpretation of hierarchy, were trained for compliance. In organizations in which few take responsibility for their own actions, at some point, something bad is going to happen, something bad that was probably highly preventable. One can't help but think again about the companies that suffer thanks to the decisions of a few selfishly minded people within their organizations. Whether these individuals act unethically, commit a crime, or simply work counter to the interests of the organization, neither they nor their leaders seem to take responsibility. Instead, they point fingers. Republicans blame Democrats, and Democrats blame Republicans when things don't get done. Mortgage companies blamed the banks, and banks blamed the mortgage companies for the 2008 financial meltdown. Let us be grateful that none of them are responsible for the care of nuclear-powered submarines. Captain Marquet came to understand that the role of the leader is not to bark commands and be completely accountable for the success or failure of the mission. It is the leader's job instead to take responsibility for the success of each member of his crew. It is the leader's job to ensure that they are well trained and feel confident to perform their duties, to give them responsibility and hold them accountable to advance the mission. If the captain provides direction and protection, the crew will do what needs to be done to advance the mission. In his book, Turn the Ship Around, Captain Marquet goes through all the specific steps that he took, that any organization can take, to develop an environment in which those who know more, the people who are actually doing the work, are empowered to make decisions. One of the things Captain Marquet did was change the culture of permission to a culture of intent. He literally banned the words "permission to" aboard the Santa Fe. "Sir, request permission to submerge the ship." "Permission granted." "Aye, aye, sir, submerging the ship." This standard way of operating was replaced with simply, "Sir, I intend to submerge the ship." The chain of command remained intact. The only difference was a psychological shift. The person performing the action now owned the action instead of carrying out an assigned task. When pushed just how far he took this "I intend" idea, Captain Marquet is quick to point out that there are only three things he can't delegate. "I can't delegate my legal responsibilities, I can't delegate my relationships, and I can't delegate my knowledge. Everything else, however, I can ask others to take responsibility for," he says. What is so remarkable about this model, and what is so important about these three responsibilities, is that though they cannot be handed off, they can all be shared. And that's what the best leaders do. They share what they know, ask knowledgeable people for help performing their duties, and make introductions to create new relationships within their networks. Poor leaders hoard these things, falsely believing it is their intelligence, rank, or relationships that make them valuable. It's not. In an organization with a strong circle of safety, not only is the leader willing to share knowledge, but so too is everyone else. Again, the leader sets the tone. When our leaders reveal their gaps in knowledge and missteps, not only are we more willing to help, but we too are more willing to share when we make mistakes or when things go wrong. Inside the circle, mistakes are not something to be feared. In organizations in which there is no safety provided, people are more likely to hide mistakes or problems out of self-preservation. The issue is, those mistakes and problems, if not addressed, often add up and appear later when they become too big to contain. This is what Captain Marquet was forced to learn. Only when confronted with a failed model, when he reached a point of failure or despair, or realized that the people acting under these conditions could never be expected to do their best work, did his entire focus and effort change course. Captain Marquet resisted acting on his instinct to take control. Now he took great delight in giving it away and seeing others rise to the responsibility they were given. The relationships aboard the submarine strengthened, and the overall culture of trust and cooperation dramatically improved. They improved so much, in fact, that under his leadership, the crew of the Santa Fe, once the lowest rated in the entire U.S. submarine fleet, became the best rated crew in Navy history. The goal of a leader is to give no orders, Captain Marquet explains. Leaders are to provide direction and intent and allow others to figure out what to do and how to get there. This is the challenge most organizations face. We train people to comply, not to think, Captain Marquet goes on. If people only comply, we can't expect people to take responsibility for their actions. The chain of command is for orders, not information. Responsibility is not doing as we're told. That's obedience. Responsibility is doing what is right. Captain Marquet did more than take his ship from worst to first. That in itself was a finite accomplishment and of no significant value to the long-term success of the organization he served. That's like making the quarter or the year but ignoring the decade. Captain Marquet created an environment in which the chemicals that incentivize behavior were more balanced. The systems he put in place aboard the Santa Fe rewarded trust and cooperation, and not just obedience and achievement. As the crew's oxytocin and serotonin levels increased, so did their pride and their concern for each other and the success of the ship. And with the social chemicals flowing, they also became much better at solving problems together. Unlike the people in Stanley O'Neill's Merrill Lynch, the crew of the Santa Fe went from waiting to be told what to do and working to protect their own hides to sacrificing for each other and working for the good of the whole. They didn't try to undermine their captain. They wanted to make him proud. And everyone benefited. The reenlistment rate went from only 3 the year before Captain Marquet took command to 33. The Navy's average is 15 to 20. On average, about 2 to 3 officers per submarine will get selected for their own command. In contrast, 9 out of the 14 officers aboard the Santa Fe went on to command their own ships. The Santa Fe didn't just make progress, it made leaders. In physics, The definition of power is the transfer of energy. We measure the power of a light bulb in watts. The higher the wattage, the more electricity is transferred into light and heat, and the more powerful the light bulb. Organizations and their leaders operate exactly the same way. The more energy is transferred from the top of the organization to those who are actually doing the job, those who know more about what's going on a daily basis, the more powerful the organization, and the more powerful the leader.